This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
This episode of Ready or Not is brought to you by Home, Melbourne's first of its kind postpartum hotel where mothers are mothered. Recently, I had the distinct pleasure of working with sisters Lucy and Emma Race on the Outer Sanctum podcast. In an eight-part series, they brought back their incredible show that looks at life through the lens of sport and welcomes all people, particularly those that are non-binary, women, or have always felt like the outer, either in sport or in life. I was disarmed by their intelligence, their ability to break down complex topics into simple forms and discussion points, and also by their humour. They are incredibly funny as they are wise. And so as soon as I met these warm and incredible women, I knew I wanted to have them on the show. As the youngest with three older brothers, I'm fascinated by sisterhood. And so today we look at sisterhood through the lens of motherhood. Working together on the Outer Sanctum podcast and making the call, and what it's like to move through life together from pre-motherhood up until now, where the pair's children range from tweens to adults. Each had their own challenges in the postpartum. And in real time, we get a sense of what it's like for this incredibly close pair to delve deeper into each other's trials and tribulations as new mothers. There's so much to learn in this episode, from what they went through in the early days of parenting, to how they reflect on it now and what it's like to make work work as a mother today. I'm Lucinda, this is Ready or Not, and here is the incredible, the insightful, the inspiring Lucy and Emma Race.
So Lucy and Emma,
I think I've told you a few times that I admire you both, and I'm so excited to be here with you today. When we were recording the Outer Sanctum podcast, Julia Chiara would be saying something brilliant, and I would always notice off to the side a bit of magic happening between you two sisters. Emma would not give you that much, Lucy. It looked to me just like a bit of a nod, a bit of a point, a bit of a suggestion. And then as soon as Julia would have finished whatever she was saying, you two would be off on some tangent that you just discussed. And I want to know, firstly, what that secret sister language is, and secondly, how you would both describe your relationship.
The secret is we're witches. No, the secret is we actually do think that we can communicate without talking, and we actually can. And I think that is a byproduct of being sisters and knowing each other for a very long time, but also having worked together for a very long time and worked together in that broadcast space as well. You would know that when you work with someone doing a podcast, there is shorthand. You do start to get clues from each other. So it might seem like magic, but there are clues that we pick up on. But Emma and I do joke about the fact that we're one jumper, two head holes, and we often are thinking the same thing. We will often text each other the same meme or come up with the same solution for something. And it's kind of magic. We're awful to play Pictionary against because we will beat you.
You can't be on the same team, surely.
No, particularly when we do have our other sister who is equally as powerful. And when the three of us are together, we are unstoppable.
She may be more powerful because she's also dangerous.
And Emma, how would you describe it then as the little sister? How would you describe your friendship, your relationship?
Well, I mean, I guess my relationship with Lucy is, it's hard to say this on a parenting podcast because I love my children. It's the most important and most formative relationship of my life. And the reason that I can attribute that kind of massive kudos to our relationship is because it's already embedded from birth and birth order. And she's my big sister. And just as a human, I think she's the most extraordinary and beautiful soul. But we work on this relationship so much. And when I say work, it's not like hard work. It's great work. It's fantastic work. But it is the relationship that I service the most in my life for many reasons. And selfishly, I think the first is because it pays me back in ridiculous amounts. The returns I get from this relationship it's the most incredible investment. So it helps because we're sisters. It helps because we like each other. We enjoy the same things and we also work together. But deeper than that, I think that we both acknowledge that the work that we do on ourselves and with each other makes us better partners, better sisters, and definitely better parents and better humans in the world. So it's like I've got, she's like a university, she's like a set of encyclopedias, a therapist, a best friend, a workout partner. I mean, Swiss Army knife doesn't even cut it with this kid. She's just something else. So the pleasure of it is, I guess, that we get to spend so much time together. So that in turn builds, it's like a self-sourcing pudding, Lucinda. It just keeps, you know, getting bigger. So yeah, we can communicate telepathically. I'm not sure if that's what you saw, but
that's
we also
definitely what I saw. If anyone doesn't believe this, I promise you this is real.
But the other great strength of us, I think, is that at sometimes we can have the exact same response to a situation, and at other times, wow, we are so poles apart. Like yeah. There is some stuff that we are just so different on. And so it keeps it spicy.
So thinking about your similarities and differences, I want to think now about, I've only just met you recently, but I'm picturing you maybe in your teens, maybe your 20s. How did you both move through the world in that sense of your thoughts around motherhood and career? Was it much of a thought until it came to be, or was it something you were always thinking of?
We're 5 years apart. So when I think back to us as young girls or as teenagers or even in our 20s, that age difference was much more apparent, and it isn't now. It's really faded as the years have gone on, and particularly as we've both hit similar stages with motherhood and with relationships and with work. So I don't know that we really talked a lot about those things when we were little. And I do think that there was a difference in the way that we played. And I was someone when I was really young who played with dolls and was obsessed with my doll pram and my doll's clothes and had kept all of my dolls up until my teenage years and often had to bribe my sisters to play that kind of game with me, whereas they were both much more outdoors, creative, active, wanted to play with the dog. Whereas I was much more internal and calm and quiet, and I liked order. They didn't. They liked chaos.
Do you think that meant that you thought about motherhood more? I feel like there's a real stereotype around that maternal type, which we know is a bit of crock of shit. But do you think that had any correlation to that sense of being a maternal person?
I think it did. I think from a very young age, I knew that I wanted to have children, and I do think that I arranged my life in a way that tried to make that a possibility. I know that there are never any there's not certainty that will happen, but I got married really young. I was 23 when I got married, and I'm still with the same partner. We've been together since I was 19, and I wanted to have children, and he was the one that put the brakes on that. We had 5 years of being married before we had our first child, and I found that really hard. I didn't want to wait. I was just so keen to have children. But, you know, when I was little, if we went down to the local shops, I would often disappear into the nursery section. I wanted to go and pick out the cot that I had my eye on or the pram or those sorts of things. I really did want to be a mother, and I wanted all of the accoutrement.
And what about you, Emma?
She used to mother me, and it drove me wild. And in fact, I've got a scar here. Do you remember this? I have a scar under my lip, which in later life grows hair out of it. So thanks for this. And it's from, she used to grab me and want to hug me and hold me all the time. Oh. And I remember trying to throw my head like to get away from it. And I put my teeth through my lip one day when mum and dad weren't home. And I remember my sisters sticking their hands in my mouth trying to find out if I'd lost any teeth, and there was just blood everywhere. But the funniest thing about it is I now have three girls, and my eldest, who is so like Lucy, does it to my youngest all the time, who is so like me. And you should see me. I come down on her like a bricks. I'm like, let go of her.
Let her live.
Bodily autonomy. She's not a doll. I'm probably a bit too over the top. So it's so funny because I think actually Lucy and I, we grew really close when Lucy became a mother. Prior to that, so I think I was like 13 or 14 when she moved out of home because of the age gap, and she moved out with her now husband and some other friends. But I, so there was a big formative part of my life that she wasn't there for, and I wasn't there for her either. But we found our way back to each other, or maybe it was the first time we kind of found our way to each other. But I do think that almost a barrier to our friendship when we were growing up was Lucy's obsession with motherhood and the fact that I was her little sister. And to be honest, Lucinda, all I wanted to do was play sport and kick the footy and talk about football and play netball and little athletics. I was so determined to be a sports person. So yeah, Felicity and I guess she was really into playing with the dog. I liked dressing the dog up. Didn't love necessarily dolls or that kind of maternal stuff. But I never discounted it. I just assumed it would happen because, you know, 1970 through 1980, there was just like, I guess that's what happens. It's what you do or something. I didn't ever rail against it or push against it, but I didn't run towards it. I saved that until I was dumped in my 30s after a 10-year relationship and found myself being a bridesmaid 9 times and having no partner and thinking, oh, hang on a minute, I haven't calculated this very well.
So how did you feel about it then? Not to drag you too far ahead, but I'm thinking about that. You say long-term relationship, you say being in your 30s. It's all of the things we attribute to when we should become parents. How did you feel when you went, okay, bit of a course direction here?
It wasn't pretty. I can tell you that Lucy, this is when Lucy really dug in. This is where she was really there for me. Man, she was getting some frequent flyer miles and even, you know, I remember her coming to pick up the pieces of this very broken woman, and she was like 9 months pregnant, came in the middle of the night in her pajamas. I was that person. I did that, you know, made that call. I was really close at that stage to my 6 nephews, and I could see what motherhood was. I could see my sisters doing it because they both had children concurrently, like year on year, because they're so close in age. So it was happening for them. So all of a sudden, from nothing to, you know, a couple of years in, I had 6 nephews, and I was completely obsessed with them. And I would do Christmas mornings at Lucy's house, and I had access to these little babies, and I just fell so hard in love. And I guess the best picture of what that was like as someone in their 30s who found themselves single at that point in time was after Lucy and I went and saw the movie Juno. I think I cried for about 12 hours. I almost couldn't stand to leave the movie. Mm. Lucy pretty much had to carry me out. I think about it now, the pain was visceral. Oh. So I knew, I was like, oh, time's up on this. I've missed the boat here. And there's no way I would have been able to afford to do it by myself.
Wow. So you did really have that sense of feeling like you'd missed out on motherhood at that stage of your life.
Yeah, I did. I went overseas. Lucy and I both traveled together in 2008. And then I went on and traveled by myself. And my last diary entry on the way home on the plane, I was about to start a new job when I got home, was I just have to accept that motherhood's not going to happen for me, but this job means that I will be the best auntie. I will take these boys on overseas holidays. I will buy them cars. I will be there for every Christmas. I will love them with my whole heart. I just thought I'd missed the boat.
Oh, that makes me so emotional. You were mothering those boys the way that your big sister mothered you. We will get to more of that, Emma. Lucy, I'm now thinking about in your 20s, you're married, your husband's saying, give it a few more years, doll. Let's just pump the brakes on this motherhood, parenthood thing. What's career life looking like at that point? Because I know that you're a very intelligent person that's made a great career for yourself. And it can often be quite an interesting seesaw of what comes first, motherhood or career. Was it that you were so obsessed with the idea of motherhood that career wasn't coming first, or both were just full steam ahead?
No, I think I was of that generation that we thought we could have everything. So I was that generation that grew up reading Dolly, where it was this outfit will take you from the boardroom to the bar. And so I thought I took that literally.
I saw a great meme about that that was like, I have not needed these day to night outfits nearly as much as those magazines.
When have I ever
me.
Had to do day to night makeup? I just haven't. But I knew that I wanted a career and I wanted it to be meaningful and I wanted it to be something to do with words and ideas. And they're the common themes through my study and through my work. And I knew that I wanted it to be something that was aligned with my values. I've always had a strong sense of what I want the world to be and that I've wanted to work in a way that is trying to bring that about. Now, I don't think the job that I had back then was necessarily doing that, but I felt like I was on a stepping stone. So we got married in 93 and in 95, my husband and I moved to Sydney for a job that I had. And I loved my job. I really enjoyed what I was doing. And I think that you can be as obsessed and as committed in one part of your life and still want the other part of your life to be moving along as well. But so we were in Sydney when he finally, I remember we were driving over the Sydney Harbour Bridge and he'd been away on a work trip and we were driving back home and he said, I think I'm ready. And my heart still skips a beat when I think about that moment. Like that's a moment that stayed with me.
I'm glad you said that about the wanting for two things, because that's definitely been my experience. One doesn't necessarily overshadow the other. So then if we think back to pregnant Lucy expecting her first baby, how did you feel about the idea of taking time off paid work and entering early motherhood?
I was fine with that. I was ready to do it and I didn't know what it would look like after that, but I, you know, was able to tell my boss, go on maternity leave. I ended up having to go on leave a little bit earlier because I went into premature labour and had to stop work. He then didn't come till 41 weeks. So
wow,
that was
you.
Interesting. But yeah, I didn't really look too far ahead about how it was all going to sort of work in the end. And I think because I was interstate and we were by ourselves, we didn't have family around us, we're really not sure about where, you know, how everything was going to work.
Yeah. And what do you recall most about those early days? I know you mentioned that there were some really hard times, that your husband traveled interstate, felt quite lonely and quite sad at times. Can you talk us through those feelings?
Yeah, I found it really hard. So I think I've kind of alluded to the fact that I'm someone who likes order and motherhood doesn't necessarily respect order. But my first son was born, he was not a very good sleeper and I was also not a very good put to sleeper. I just didn't know. And not having my mum around, not having my sisters around, I really relied on my mother's group and the local maternal child health centre. And that was really the support that I had. My husband travelled a lot of overseas travel and a lot of really long trips. I was lucky at that time in a way that our parents they were living in Melbourne and they had a business where they would often be in Sydney. And so my favourite time was when they were in town and they would come and stay, and that just felt like absolute respite just to have that other set of hands. But it was very isolating and was also at a time before mobile phones, before internet. So there was no FaceTime, there wasn't social media, which I think has been a blessing and a curse in my motherhood journey. But in terms of having somebody just there when you needed them, that really didn't exist. I had one book, two books maybe, that I would consult anytime I had a question about anything. I didn't really have the internet. I didn't have a laptop. I didn't have a computer. I didn't have a car. So I'd had a company car, which I had to give back. So yeah, it was quite a different experience to what I had by the time I had my third.
Yeah. And so you mentioned when we were emailing that you did feel quite depressed when your first and your second were around 1 and 3 and that it led to a little bit of a gap to then bring your third boy into the world. How do you reflect on what you did to feel ready and to feel, I don't know, maybe a bit more whole after a period of feeling a bit isolated?
Yeah. So we moved back to Melbourne in 2000. So that was with a 2-year-old and an 8-week-old. So while everyone else was moving into Sydney for the Sydney Olympics, we were moving out. And people were saying, why aren't you staying? I was like, there was absolutely no part of me that could imagine being able to go to the Olympics with a 2-year-old and a newborn. So I was like, I'm getting out of there. So we came back to Melbourne, and I think that's when I did feel quite depressed. And I think that I thought coming back to Melbourne, all of a sudden, my loneliness would be rectified, that everything would be a lot easier. And it actually wasn't, because, of course, everybody else is busy and everyone else has their own things happening. And also, a lot of the reasons that I was struggling were not to do with necessarily support structures. They were to do with my ideas of how things should be and the challenge, I guess, of being a perfectionist who was trying to make their way with two small boys who had their own ideas of how the day should go, and counselling. I went and saw a psychologist, and I saw her for a year, and it was the best thing I ever did. And so doing that work was the difference between getting back and finding healthy ways of dealing with the chaos. And, you know, it's not a quick fix. It wasn't a quick fix. It's been a lifetime of, I guess, trying to be more embracing of chaos and letting myself fail and being okay with mess and all of those things. But it just took time to be ready for number three.
And before we started recording, you and I briefly touched on the fact that my mental health has definitely been impacted by Posey's lack of sleep.
Mm.
We're just starting to get somewhere. I can already feel the fog almost clearing. Your first baby didn't sleep all that well, and we talked about how that affected your mental health. What support mechanisms did you use or implement to get through that time?
Yeah, I found that really tough. I initially was turned up at my maternal health center with, I think I was in pajamas. He was in pajamas. This is when I was in Sydney, and walked in the door and just went, I don't know what I'm doing. And thankfully, they were able to scoop me up and help me in that moment. They were able to, they put him down and he went straight to sleep. Oh, so then I'd sat in the waiting room and I couldn't sleep. But at least he slept. So I just sat there going, what the hell? What's going on? So that was helpful. But I ended up going to sleep school with him, and that was very helpful. The other thing that we did was we decided to, he slept better when we were out and about. So my husband and I decided to take him to Europe when he was 12 weeks old, which was
smart.
Smart. Also a bit crazy. But so we traveled.
And is that maybe where your baby met Emma? Is that right?
That's right. So Emma was overseas backpacking and hadn't been in Australia when he was born. And so Emma met Jake on a train station in La Rochelle in France when he was about 12 weeks old. And that was actually, I look back on it and think, what were we thinking? But a 12-week-old baby traveling is actually pretty good.
I reckon better than an 18-month-old. I remember taking Ray at about 6 months versus about 15 months. 6 months, way easier in our experience. So I could not agree more. Emma, you meet this new person, this mum in Europe, this 12-week-old baby, and then your sister goes on to have two more. What do you remember most about experiencing Lucy become a mum? And I guess how it informed how you might go about it one day.
It's so funny thinking about that now, because when I met Jake, and I remember hopping in the car, I held him for the first time. He's tiny. He's just like this little dot of a thing. And I've just been, you know, drunk the night before in Spain, jumped on a train. I've got a hangover, meet my sister and her kid and all the accoutrement at a train station. We almost missed the train. I remember that. And we get in the back of the car and Jake's in the baby capsule, and my friend and I are relegated to those tiny little seats in the boot of a European station wagon. And I'm just staring at him. I just couldn't get enough. And Lucy goes, don't look at him. It's time for him to sleep. So please don't look at him. I was like, so motherhood's going.
Do not look at my child.
I think back on that now, and that is a different person to who she is now, obviously. But you know, I held on that tightly when I became a mother too. So I completely get it. That's what happens to you. You are so ordained by anything that little person needs. And that is number one. And I got told early and I didn't make the mistake again. But, you know, watching Lucy in those early days, I found it really hard, to be honest. It didn't look like fun. She got everything she wanted. And it just, in the really early days, it looked so hard. And so it didn't really affect me. I wasn't really at that point in my life of wanting kids. It was when they got older. And, you know, everyone thinks babies are great, but as soon as they could sing and dance and hit a golf club and make us laugh, it was like another universe was created. And I watched her relationship with these boys and the friendship and the adventure. And it was like my heart just burst out of my chest. And it was everything, really. Yeah. I was like, that's what I want. Like, I want that. Yeah. And I didn't want it exactly the same as she had it. And I didn't want it the same as my other sister had it. But I was like, this looks like it might be the meaning of life. And of course, that was just sliding doors. That was happening just as I was breaking up with my partner of 10 years. And so maybe I wanted it more because of that. I don't even know. But at that point, I was like, this is a no-brainer because these little boys, I would lie down in traffic for them. I was such a boring 30-year-old. This is why I was single for so long, because I'd go out and all I'd do is tell people stories about my nephews. I mean, how boring.
Oh, my God.
Is that?
I was like that too about my nieces. Yeah.
I was obsessed. I was absolutely obsessed. And I was so fortunate that I had six come so quickly. Like, you know, if you didn't like that one, wait 5 minutes. There'll be another one. I wasn't like that at all.
There's another one
I love them all equally, but it was just so fun. I got to be the fun auntie and they loved me so much. I like to think they still do. But man, the bonds that I created with them in those early years to be able to be an auntie when I didn't have my own children and when they were the whole of my world. I know that my sisters love my daughters, but I can't, there's just nothing that can compare to this. Like, we had our own language. We had our own nicknames.
And you had time.
I had time. I had so much time. I just loved it so much. I loved being an auntie so hard that I actually feared that being a mother would not stack up.
I actually can relate to that so much because I became an auntie before I became a mum. And I actually had a bit of mourning when I was pregnant for those relationships changing because it did feel like such a gift to be given maybe like a part of motherhood before entering motherhood myself because it was in such close quarters. Emma, I'm thinking about the you that's had this breakup, that's watching these babies turn into children, come to life, become people that you're obsessed with, and that you're thinking motherhood might not happen for you, but there's a lot of other beautiful parts of your life that you're dedicating yourself to. There's the nephews. I'm wondering then how much career came into that sort of idea of a life's work and your life's purpose when you were jostling with if motherhood would come to be or not?
Yeah, it was everything to me. Like, I invested really heavily in my career and it meant that I could do jobs that I wasn't getting paid for. You know, like, I was able to really live out my dreams a bit, you know, like really go for it because I was like, well, what's the point? I mean, you know, like, mum and dad wanted us, I think, you know, we got left this tiny bit of money from when our grandparents died. And mum and dad were so lovely to share that with us. And mum and dad were like, you know, you should put that towards buying a house. And I was like, I could do that or could just go overseas. Like, I wasn't planning for the future. I was like, throw it all in. Who cares? Like, I'm not going to have kids. This isn't going to happen for me. So I fully was invested. It's hard to go back to that time now that I'm a mother of three to even open that door and remember who I was at that point. But I knew what I wanted to do with my career and I was doing it. So I was really happy. I was like working as a talent manager, but I was also kind of doing a bit of comedy, a bit of producing, a bit of presenting on the side, stuff like that. And I was really lucky. I always felt really, really lucky that I knew what I wanted to do. I think, you know, you can know that you want to be a parent. That feels pretty innate. You know, and sometimes people have a very strong feeling about whether they do or don't, but knowing what you want to do in your career is also such a gift. Yes. And I think you're really lucky if you know what you want to do, because that's really is 50% of the struggle. So I was really living my best life, even though I did feel like there was something missing.
And then you eventually do become a mum. What do you remember most about pregnancy and being on that threshold of crossing over to motherhood?
Well, the whole thing happened so quickly. It was just a joke. I met my husband, also named Lucy, and I both have husbands with the same name, which is so annoying. for some reason we know which one we're talking about. So my Andy, he and I met, I'm just going to say it like this, we met in the last round of the AFL season in 2008. And that was obviously, you know, August heading into September, and we got engaged in December. So that'll happen quickly. We got married in May. I got pregnant on the honeymoon, and then I had 3 kids in 4 years. So it was an absolute whirlwind, but he's 12 years older than me. I was already 34 when I met him. And, you know, I remember on a really early first date, I was like, you must have family somewhere. Where are you hiding these children and all these ex-wives? You must have them. And I don't know if they still haven't turned up, but they could. But I said, you know, I had learnt my lesson, I think, from previous relationships. And I basically said to him, why aren't you married? And he said, oh, I'm not really the marrying type. And I said, I'm going to have to stop you right here. Like, get off this ride, because I am. I know it's what I want. I've got this little window left. I want to be a mum. I want to be with someone who wants to build a life together. And if that's not you, then, you know, it's been fun. See you later. And he was like, oh, and within like, you know, a minute turnaround, he was like, it could be me. And he reassessed everything that he was thinking. And I was like, well, that was pretty easy, actually.
Just like me.
And then I remember walking through, we weren't married, we weren't engaged. We'd only been kind of seeing each other for a couple of weeks, and walking through Chemist Warehouse. And I was like, should I get the folate? There, I'm doing folate jokes, right? And he goes, well, what does it do? And I told him, and he goes, well, go on then. So we actually did start trying to get pregnant probably 8 weeks after meeting each other. And it didn't happen until the honeymoon. But then once it happened, man, it hit me hard. And I loved being pregnant at the start, because who knew if you could get pregnant? I'd never been pregnant before. And I was sick as anything. But then it was birth, and straight after birth, that I found all my challenges came. Everything had come pretty easy to me until then. And then it was just hard.
Imagine a place where postpartum professionals who are mostly mothers themselves and who feel more like your aunties and cousins than staff cook wholesome food for you and your baby, wash, fold and put away your clothes, run magnesium-filled baths, massage your tired body, bring you cups of tea and nourishing treats to your plush bed. Take your baby overnight and have deep conversations with you about the beauty and pain of motherhood. While you sit your tired body down in the dining room, as smells of breakfast, tea and coffee fill the air. Morning light streams in and dances over a bowl of lemons, a big vase of flowers, and soft tunes fill the space. No, this isn't some dreamt up land that we can only access in our sleep. This exists at home, the first of its kind postpartum hotel where mothers are mothered. After giving birth to her first child, Home founder Larissa Leone found herself lost in the very early stages of becoming a mother, an experience that is incredibly common. She had wonderful support but felt very alone and didn't want to let on that she wasn't coping. After finding herself in some very dark places, she decided to speak up because she knew she needed help. She was later diagnosed with postnatal depression and anxiety, and now Home's mission is to assist in the prevention of just that, of exactly what Larissa experienced, by providing holistic care, nourishment and support, all while nurturing and honouring one of the most profound shifts a human being can go through, the matrescence period. Home is a place of soft spaces for hard things to land, a safe space that empowers you to forge your own path and provides the encouragement, education and support needed for you and your family to thrive. To learn more about Home and the Home Trust, a registered charity that exists to provide financially supported stays to families in need, and to book your own stay at the place where mothers are mothered, visit home.com.au. That's Home spelled H-O-M-B.
So let's talk about then wherever you're comfortable going. You had some birth trauma and breastfeeding was just not what we see on the posters for you, for a lack of better terminology. What do you recall most about those two experiences?
Just failure, just feeling like an absolute failure, feeling like I couldn't So my baby got stuck. I did like 54 hours worth of labor. I just basically at the end said, just cut me open, take the baby and let me die, which seems extreme, but Lucy was there and the whole thing was pretty awful. And I've got to be really honest and say that I couldn't quite believe, with all of the education and all of the books by that point, we're talking about 2010, how many people were talking about parenthood, like the increase in resources that I had compared to what Lucy described in 98, is that when you had Jake in 98, was extraordinary. Like it was just insane how much had changed. And yet there I was, I didn't know what would happen if I had a cesarean. All I remember is that at birthing classes, they'd said, you know, you'll give birth and they'll hand you the baby and it will look up at you and it will lock eyes with you and it will know that you're its mother and then your milk will come in and everything. Well, that didn't happen for me because I was splayed out on a table being cut open. I didn't get to hold her. She didn't get to look up in my eyes. And by the time I did get to hold her, obviously it was amazing, but then my milk never came in. And I had also never been told that my milk wouldn't come in. And then I'm in this state. I was in an absolute state afterwards. I was absolutely had birth trauma. And until I started talking about that with some people, I really only found one other person in my circle of friends who knew exactly what I was talking about. And we both looked at each other like ashen faced. And it took me years to get over it. And I still don't really hear people talking about it that much. And I also had no idea that you could not have enough milk. Like, so I spent the first, well, I spent the first 18 months of motherhood, which included two children, because then I got pregnant 5 months after I'd had Millie. Ridiculous. Anyway, so I was pregnant when Millie was 5 months old. And I spent 18 months attached to a breast pump that was enormous and you couldn't travel with it. And the sound of it still gives me nightmares. And I was getting like 10 mils after like 45 minutes. And I just was attached to it constantly and terrified of feeding my children formula in public. And I found it really confusing how they'd say, if you give them formula, your milk will never come in. I'm like, how do my boobs know whether I'm getting milk out of a can? Like, I just didn't understand it. And then I think this is probably the most traumatic thing, and I'll say it out loud because I'm a long way from that place now, but I remember going to the maternal health nurse and she looked at me and she said, "Dick baby is starving." And hearing that, it just stops me in my tracks. I'm like, I was busting my ass. I was doing everything they said. I was eating the weirdest stuff. I was putting on weight so quickly because I was having all this like baker's, like this yeasty product, all this stuff, like felt awful about myself. And I reckon I stayed in that for like maybe the first 3 years of motherhood. And then I got pregnant with Phoebe.
But
that was all right. I'd kind of repaired it a bit by the time, like Lucy, when I was repaired a bit to go back for a third one.
I knew one and two came quickly. I didn't realize you were pregnant at 5 months. That is quite a journey. When do you think you were able to free yourself of pumping, of trying to get this milk? Or were you? Did it take someone pulling you aside and saying, hey, I know everyone has told you that breast is best, but there actually is another way? What was it?
Well, by then, I mean, both of my kids were just on formula. They had to be on formula, but I was trying to top them up all the time because I thought it was best. And there was a moment after I had, so Millie, I think I probably breastfed her until I tried to breastfeed her, I should say. It wasn't at all successful. It was really just for closeness at that point. And probably for her, it was like 8 months I tried. By then I was pregnant again. And then with Sophie, I remember day three or whatever, milk didn't come in because they all said it might be different the next time. Lucy had the unfortunate responsibility of being in the room with me when I realized it wasn't going to happen again. I locked myself in the bathroom at the hotel that I was in after birth and just sat on the floor and just wept. And I think she and Andy were probably outside the bathroom door going, what are we going to do? And then I just had to accept that it wasn't going to happen, and it never happened. I tried everything I could with Soph probably for 3 or 4 months. And then I just was like, as soon as I freed myself from it, it felt like the world changed, really.
Yeah.
And I look at them now, like they're 13 and 14 and they're giants and they're healthy and they are different to each other. Like nothing I did would have changed who they ended up becoming. And I wish that I could have told myself that. Maybe people told me, but you don't hear it in the moment. But I am so here for this conversation because I just feel like people need to know that it can happen. And it hasn't made me a worse mother. I'm an unreal mother. It's exactly the role I was meant to play, and I'm the best mum for these kids, and they are healthy and awesome and all completely different.
Yeah. We put up a poll recently on the Ready or Not Instagram all around breastfeeding, and the amount of people that had challenges was huge, and the common theme was shame. Everyone felt some sense of shame and like they couldn't give their baby what they needed, which broke my heart. I'm very fortunate that I haven't had to go through that. But if I had, I'm sure I would have felt the same, even though I could sit here today and say, no, I'd be kind to myself. As you say, when you're in it, you don't hear all the outside noise. If someone really close to you came to you tomorrow and said, there's no milk, I'm finding this hard, I'm not feeling good about myself, what would you tell them?
I would hold them and I would say, I get it. But on the other side, you're going to be okay. And you do what you need to do for as long as you need to do it, but also do this other thing. Like, I would give them unlimited support and understand that the shame is real. Like, it's not, we didn't fabricate it. It's real. Like, I remember, Lucy, when we were working together and you were pumping sometimes in the studio, at times I had to swallow my envy.
Yes.
Watching you pump while you were working, I was like, oh, wow. Like, I had friends who had to pump if we were out for a night and they would just like dump it down the toilet. Like, they were squeezing milk into toilets because their breasts were engorged or whatever. And my envy was real even when I was long past breastfeeding. I was like, I don't understand. I'm such a failure. Why did my body fail me like this? And it made me have a really weird relationship with my body for a really long time. Like, I really punished myself with running marathons and stuff, half marathons and, you know, in between each of the, like in between my pregnancies and stuff. Wow. Cause I was like, well, if you can't do that, then what else can you do? Like, oh my gosh, like forgive yourself and move on.
There's a photo.
Emma has a photo of herself with one of the babies strapped to her and she's working with a personal trainer. I'm doing some boxing.
Wow, because you just needed to go, well, I can do these other things.
Yeah, I've let go of it now, which is lucky, but I think it's important to say these things because, like, I didn't know how else to exercise the demons of it, right? Because it just didn't feel like it was being, it didn't really feel like it was a conversation. For such a long time, it was my personality in a way. Like, it was all secret. And I don't, like, thank God my marriage survived that. Like, because Andy was very like, hey, baby's still getting fed. You probably don't need to pump so much if you don't want to, but you can if you want. And like, I didn't want to have people over because I'm like, this bloody breast pump sitting on the dining room table. And I'm constantly got my boobs out and I'm ashamed of them and I hate them. And I hated them, hated my boobies so much.
How does that sit with you now as someone raising daughters? I'm sure that's come into your mind in terms of that self-hate piece and wanting to make sure that they love their bodies and not just because they're girls, but any kids, we all want them to love their bodies.
Yeah, I really keep my own personal relationship with my body really, I keep that away from my kids.
Yeah.
I keep that away from my kids and I will have a conversation with them if they want to. And I do open up about, you know, when I can see them struggling, if they ask me questions, but otherwise I really adopt. And I think it works over time. I adopt self-love and I look after myself in their eyes. I remember when they were really little holding them saying, I need to be the best I can be for you in whatever that looks like. And I have found that. So I'm very lucky that I have found that. I don't make any assumptions about these three girls that any of them will be mothers or will want to be mothers. And we won't know that until it presents itself. But I have gone the gamut from, if you happen to get pregnant at 14, I am your first call.
Yeah.
No matter what, and whatever you choose, I accept it and I will do it and I will do it with pleasure. And all the way through to if you don't have children, if you become a unicorn, you are loved and you can stay here and live with me and I will hand rear you for the rest of my life. Like, whatever they are, I will love and accept, and that is my go-to and that's what I will do. Yeah,
and that's the foundation for all of the things that might flow from there. So I think that's a beautiful sentiment. As much as you had these challenges, parental leave was also a time of profound professional growth for you. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so I was really, lucky, I guess. When I had my first child, I finished work and there was no paid maternal leave in that job. So, and obviously then I got pregnant really quickly the second time. So I was just at home. And then I found some equilibrium when I had Phoebe. She was born 2 years, 9 months after Sophie. And so Sophie was born 14 months after Millie. I felt like that 2 years, 9 months was a lifetime, by the way. Like, not getting pregnant straight away was such a lovely, felt like a luxury. But I do acknowledge now that if I hadn't have had Soph so quickly and she hadn't have been a surprise, then I probably wouldn't have been able to have three kids. And so, you know, a third really was just joy. It was cherry on top stuff. And I feel so lucky to have her. So when Phoebe was little, that was when the others were at, you know, kinder. I never had daycare, never had nanny help or anything like that. And in fact, my parents were almost a bit too old to really be able to help me. In some ways, I feel envious that Lucy kind of got the best of mum and dad, you know, in the how old they were, even though I know she was in Sydney. They were really engaged with her kids when they were really little. And by the time I had kids, our parents were just a bit older. And so it just felt a bit different, I think. But the work thing meant that I was home and I cannot be idle. And as hard as parenting is, I needed something else. And so I did a podcasting course. I started an app, which failed, but I built an app when I was at home with all three of them. I was trying to hustle. I was trying to hustle something so that I could bring in money and entertain my mind while I was also, you know, trying to bring up the kids. Because I realized that I wasn't my best self if I was just parenting. Like, it's what I wanted. But I would look at the clock some days and go, are you kidding me? It's 8:30 in the morning. I've done this. How long is the day going to go for? I found it boring at times. And I feel so mean saying that because I wanted it so bad. But oh my goodness, my brain rot was just intense. I was like, I need something else. I need to be doing something. And so I was always kind of creating on the side. And then, you know, being at home meant that I had the freedom that I wasn't going to work. And what a lucky position I was in. My husband worked 6 days a week. So there was really it was a no-brainer that I was the stay-at-home parent. And, you know, even when he is at work, he's not accessible. So, you know, if anyone's sick, it needs to be me. So I knew I had to hustle. I had to make something so that I could be there at 3:30 every day when they came home from school. I could be at home if they were unwell. Like, I never really had to call on anyone else. I was always available to them, and that was my choice, and that was his choice too. I guess if I'd had a high-flying something else career, then, you know, maybe we would have had daycare and nannies and help and all that kind of stuff, but it was just all me. And so that was when I was able to kind of dig in and think, what do I want to do? And I had, you know, a couple of failed starts in kind of creative and digital spaces, and then one that I guess stuck, and that was the Outer Sanctum podcast.
You have just been watching Posey flying all over the camera. You held it together beautifully. That is a perfect segue to two incredible projects and businesses that you've had together and have together. Maybe Lucy will segue over to you. Tell us a little bit about the Outer Sanctum and Making the Call.
So the Outer Sanctum is a podcast that we began with four other women. So our sister Felicity and three other awesome women back in 2016. And it was basically, it is a podcast that talks about a whole lot of issues, but through the prism of football. So we were a bunch of football loving sisters. I say sisters in the broad sense. And we were having a lot of conversations about the sport that we loved, that we didn't always felt loved. We felt like the sport didn't always love us back. And there were things that were happening, particularly around that time. I'm thinking of Adam Goods being booed out of the game. So there were a lot of things happening in the men's game that were really challenging how we felt as football fans. And the Outer Sanctum was a podcast that talked about our relationship with football and what it was like to sit in the outer and be part of something that we didn't always feel like we belonged, or that we didn't feel like it wanted us and challenged us. So we were doing that once a week. We started it with a little handheld recorder and basically rode the wave of probably the second wave of podcasting at a time when everybody didn't have a podcast. And we had to explain what a podcast was. The other business that Emma and I have is Making the Call, which is a pathway program for women and non-binary people to find work in sports media and sports broadcasting. And that really did grow out of conversations that we were having on the Outer Sanctum. So while we were talking about football, we were seeing the birth of AFLW, which just gave way to so many opportunities for women and non-binary people to find a place in football at the highest level. And we could see that there were pathways for people in coaching. There were pathways to be able to play the whole way through. And so that if you were talented enough, you could play at the elite level. And even pathways for people who wanted to be on boards and to be part of sports governance. But we didn't see that there was anybody doing that particularly for broadcasting. So that's making the call. And Emma and I have worked together on that particular project for 4 years, I think it is. We have over 100 graduates of that program. You will have heard them. You will have read their pieces. You will have seen them on the sidelines, not just of football, but of so many different other sports. And I think in both of those projects, we've found a way to carve out work that we find meaningful, that fits within our family commitments. And that's no mean feat, given that our kids are all at very, very different ages and stages. So when the Outer Sanctum started, I had children in high school, children in primary school. Emma had younger children. I think some of those early episodes, we had Pippi sitting on the bench riding shotgun or sitting in a corner. And it's really kind of been there as our children have grown up, which has been pretty precious.
I want to get to what making work work and what parenting looks like in both of your phases of parenting now, which is obviously very different to mine. But before we do, Lucy, you've just reminded me about something interesting you said in our email chat about your idea of gender then versus now. Can you speak to that experience a bit?
Yeah, I can. And, you know, so I'm one of three girls and I've always been a very girly girl and didn't really even have a lot of boys around us growing up. A lot of our parents' friends had daughters. And when I pictured myself as a mother, I pictured myself as having daughters, or at least one daughter. And so I did think a lot about the gender of the children that I would potentially have. And I made a lot of assumptions around that. And the thing that I have learned after many years of parenting is that you just can't make these assumptions. And the things that I thought that I would miss out on because I didn't have a daughter, I've actually had in bucket loads, in spades. And what it's reminded me of is that, and it's even thinking back to Emma's, I found that very emotional listening to Emma talk about her early days of motherhood and giving birth and feeding her babies. And I think that pain still sits very heavily. I can feel it in the same way that if my children have pain, I feel it when my sisters have pain. And I think the common thread in all of this is that we make these assumptions about what motherhood's going to look like and what our lives are going to look like. And we sometimes cling to that quite tightly. And the best and the way to, I guess, make it work is to not hold so tightly to those things, because often those assumptions are wrong and often you're holding on to something that's actually just holding you back. And if you can go with the flow a bit more and just see what's in front of you, see what you've got, then you will find it a lot more, not necessarily rewarding, but you really will get out of your own way. And so I think back in the day when I was pregnant and, you know, having children, people would say, oh, you've got boys. Well, you know, this will be what your life is. Or, oh, you must be so disappointed that you don't have a daughter. Oh, boys will leave you, or all of those sorts of things. People are very, very open with their advice and they're chipping in their two cents. And I wish they wouldn't, because nobody knows who your children are going to be. They're all going to have their own gifts and their own temperament. And gender's really not necessarily a big part of that.
It's like it narrows your worldview before they've even created a worldview for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've got these expectations on, you know, just because you have a son, that this is what their life is going to be and this is what your relationship's going to be, and that's ridiculous. It's just not true.
Can I say something about, you know, how you were saying, you know, holding yourself so tightly or whatever, and it reminded me that in a different way, I feel like I held my breath when I had my kids. I felt like I held my breath, I reckon, for the first 5 years. I think that like maybe like a week or two in, I still thought I was the same person, but now I had a baby. And then there was a moment I remember going, oh, this is my life now. This is it now. I can never leave the house. I can't go to the supermarket. I will never, like, I remember having that moment of like, I'm in a prison of my own making. What have I done, right? I had that moment, even though I wanted it so badly. And at that moment, I took a breath and I held my breath, I reckon, for 4.5 or 5 years of motherhood. And because of that, I had no margins for anything, to any wiggle room. If it took me too long sitting in the chair at Medicare to get my rebate, I would leave it there and leave, because I was like, my margins are so narrow. I have no wiggle room, because the child needs to go to sleep. This one needs to be fed. That one needs to, and I was on the clock. And I have never known anything like it. It was like I punched my card when I gave birth and I was on. And the only way I knew how to control it, which obviously I now realize you can't, was just to hold my breath, hold myself so tightly, held other people to account in ways that I would never do now. I was in absolute survival mode, and it was the only way I knew how to do it. And I was holding on so tight. And I reckon 5 years in, maybe I realized I couldn't keep doing it because it was killing me. And then the world was happening around me and other things were coming upon me that I couldn't control. And so I had to exhale and I had to let things go. But the thing I would say about that is, on this parenting podcast, is that the only reason why people share their experience of parenting is not because we think that it's going to necessarily help you or change you. If someone's listening to this right now and they're holding their breath, they won't exhale because I've told them it was okay when I finally did. It's just to say, I was there too. Because no amount of parenting books or podcasts or conversations is actually going to change the experience for you. It is just to say, you are not alone. So let's share these experiences, because they're so different. Yeah. Lucy and I are telepathic, but we've had completely different parenting experiences, and we're going to end up in a really similar place just because of our ethos and our values. But gee, it took us a really different way to get there, and the pain is palpable. When I talk about the way that I saw her parenting in those early days with Jake and Jord, I swear I could lie down and cry, Lou. Like, it kills me when I think about what you even looked like then. Like, I didn't know how to reach you and I didn't know how to help you. And that's how you felt when I couldn't breastfeed.
Yeah.
But nothing changed that. Nothing was going to change that. It's as something as a parent, it's, you just have to be there. You just have to get through it.
It's like the blessing and curse of it, isn't it? Because there's so much learnings through it. But gee, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a trial run before actually doing the real thing?
But you would never then do the real thing.
No.
That's actually a very good point. Maybe you and I did, Emma, because we were aunties and we still went for it, because for whatever reason, we still want it, and it's still beautiful despite all of these challenges. You've led me to a beautiful segue with this idea of holding on to your breath for 5 years. And that's that sometimes I find the early days of parenting really hard, but also I have this fear of nostalgia because they're only little ones and we're told that all the time. So I'd love to hear from you what parenting is looking like in your stage, because I know that you're both finding so much joy in growing up with your children. So I'd love to, I guess, be comforted. Oh, it doesn't have to be comforting. You can tell me about the challenges too, but I'd love to understand what parenting is looking like at your stage.
Mine is, I have adult children now. So all of my children are adults. They're 26, 24 and 19. And two of them, the 19 and the 24-year-old, still live at home. And honestly, the greatest joy of my life. And I think there are still challenges. I think parenting is challenging through all of the stages. And that whole adage of once you have children, your heart lives on the outside of your body is very apt. And I really felt that, particularly at those times where they would move away and become more independent. And I think that is a very challenging part of parenting, to let them go and let them fail and let them try things and know that they're going out into the world where it might not be safe, getting their license, being able to go and drink in a pub. All of those things are really, really challenging. But having these adults around me who teach me easily as much as I've taught them is seriously just the greatest joy. And I appreciate it so much. And also, you know, having that opportunity to then be able to spend more time with my nephews and nieces, because I think, you know, I do have a beautiful relationship with my nephews and nieces. I absolutely adore all of them. And I've had a very different experience to Emma, because I became an auntie when I was a mother and when I was in the trenches. But it's been also lovely, because Emma's girls are that little bit younger, that I've had the chance to be an auntie with them in a way that I think I was able to bring a different perspective. I think I've been more relaxed and more available to them than I would have been if Emma and I were having children at the same time. And I get so much from those relationships. So they never stop needing you. You never stop being their parent. It's the issues sometimes I think are more difficult as they get older, because it's, you know, big real world stuff that you can't fix. But I really do have enjoyed all of the stages on the way through. If I could possibly wave a magic wand and go back and visit with them with the way that I am now and the mother that I am now and knowing everything that I know now, I would give anything to go back and just have a visit with all of my kids at those different stages, particularly just, you know, those little toddler years where I didn't think they were smart or funny. I thought they were just being very, very tricky and annoying, but they were actually just divine.
It's funny you bring up nostalgia, because, you know, we love talking about nostalgia, Lucinda. I remember feeling really bereft at when the kids would grow out of their clothes when they were little. And I was like, I must keep that. I must keep that. And I was notoriously like the record keeper of everything. I was, you know, circle their hands and take a photo and get a first day of school and how tall are they? And like all the things, right? And I was like, I had three of them under four. So it was a lot. Like I was like, no, I wasn't letting go of anything. I was holding my breath. I was circling their hands, you know, keeping all the artwork, all that kind of stuff. And then there was this moment when I realized they're not going anywhere. I've got them. This is it. I'm missing the moments because I'm trying to save the moments. And it released something in me where I was like, oh, the capturing is the everyday. It's that I have routine with them. It's that we have jokes with each other. And as they grow older, we're growing more into that. Like there's a closeness to their, like, I remember when Millie was really little, I remember like patting her on the hand or something one time. And I felt shocked that I couldn't feel that, because I felt like she was so me. Like she's my body. She is my like she's a part of me so much. How can I not feel this? Because all her emotions, I feel them so deeply. And that never changes, right? Like, but the relationship now, so they're 14, 13, and 10. Like I just went upstairs before to their ridiculously messy bathroom. Three girls obsessed with buying all this stuff from Mecca. They spend more there than I do. I don't know how this happens. And I stood in the bathroom and I inhaled. And it was the same as I used to do on the back of their necks when they were newborns, because it smelt like them. And they're at school right now and they'll come home and they'll be starving, hungry, and they'll stink of BO and they'll have all sorts of complaints from their day. Those little pimply faces, I can't wait to get up in their grill. It just never changes, right? Like I'm almost more obsessed with them now. So the nostalgia, I've been able to give way to like the iconography of that or the things that I thought that I'd hang on to forever because I'm choosing to be in the actual moment with them and that's making me a better parent. It's making me a better mother. I'm enjoying the experience. Like I fully enjoy them now. I enjoy them into every corner that I possibly can. Even last night, we're walking home. We went and got ice cream after we had dinner last night. We just walked to our local place. We're walking home. It's a beautiful spring night. And they look like they've just washed up from like castaways because they just wear the most ridiculous clothes that I'm like, oh my God, that 90s fashion makes me want to scratch my eyeballs out. They all think that they look so great. And I'm just accepting it and rolling with it and being, you know, this awesome mum that I am. And the one's on the skateboard and two of them are having a fight, whatever. And I just said, you know, this is what I wanted. You guys are my actual dream. I'm having a moment. And they all looked at me, rolled their eyes and kept walking. And I just thought, this is great. This is what it's meant to be like, right? Like this is parenting. And the older I get, the longer I parent, the more I respect my parents. Yes. I'm becoming a better daughter because I'm like, you know, I always thought mum was quite harsh with us, but I'm probably way harsher. But also, like, I realize now I'm still my parents' daughter. They're in their 80s and I am still their child. And I'm seeing mum and dad tonight. I can't wait because I get to show off what I made. Like, it's exactly the same as when my kids come home with a piece of artwork or whatever, but I get to show off what I made. And it's three girls who are incredible. But yeah, so I'm finding that. And then the other part of it is, you know, rearranging my life that I've always really valued friendships and tried really hard to keep all those balls in the air and kind of pretending that I wasn't a parent or something because I didn't want to disappoint my friends. But really, I did a little audit recently and I was like, I now have six nephews who are adults and they are my friends and I have to make room because I want to be around them. They're the people I learn from. They're the people that entertain me. They fill up my cup. They make me better. They teach me things. They challenge me. They make me smarter. They make me feel old, all the things. But with six nephews, two step nieces and three daughters, they're the people that will be there for me for the rest of my life. And I want to be there for them. And I want to keep challenging myself and delighting them too. And so that's the other part of it, that I'm not the 30-year-old single girl that I was. I don't have hours. I don't have extra hours anymore.
You probably don't have minutes.
No, not really. But like, so I have to choose where I spend them. And I've had to learn how to be okay with that and to own it and say, that's my reality. This is a choice that I've made and it's a choice I'm going to make going forward.
Oh, you both could have brought me to tears with your little nuggets there. That was bloody beautiful. I could talk to you both for so long. And it's a good reminder, Emma, to stay in the moment. I know that's cliche, but sometimes I feel like I'm taking so many photos of my babies for fear of not remembering it or not having that memory. But then I'm not even there because I've got my phone out to take a photo of them. And I said that to my husband the other day. So it's a really nice reminder to not worry so much about the cataloging as much as the just being in it. Before I let you go, if you could go back to the beginning of your motherhood journey and tell yourself anything, what would it be? And just for anyone listening, I'll just let you know how sort of symbiotic these two are. They both just shut their eyes at the exact same time to think about that and looked the same, even though they sort of only semi looked the same, but they just looked identical while they were doing that.
I'm glad you told us because I didn't see her do that because I closed my eyes. You go first, Noodle.
Oh, it's such a hard one. I think it would just have to be just let go. Just let go of expectation, let go of perfectionism. Just be in the moment, meet the kids where they are, let them meet you where you are, and that's enough, honestly, just to let go and don't hold yourself so tight.
Yeah.
I think that this is my lesson for life, actually, that the healthier my relationship with myself, the better my relationship with everyone else. Whitney Houston didn't get it wrong when she said it's the greatest love of all.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about the relationship with your kids. Like, honestly, learning to love myself has literally made me such a better person in every relationship. And so that's the challenge because motherhood has, or parenting has absolutely challenged everything that I've ever known about myself. And I feel like we've touched on it today. We've been back to the depths and whatever you can withstand in that. The more you can love yourself, the healthier and happier you are with exactly who you are, and actually making sure you prioritize what it is that you need, fitting your oxygen mask first. It just makes so much sense to me now. I actually kind of really understand it now. And I assume as I get older, I will understand it more and more. But the more I fit my own oxygen mask, and just the better I am for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I think generally, if I could go back, I'd say to myself, oh, you don't even know how good you are at this. You're going to be so good at this. These kids are so lucky, and you are so lucky to have them, because you're going to be great at this.
That's a beautiful parting message, because I think it's something that not many parents do. I love you both. I think you're both amazing. I'm nearly in tears because I've enjoyed this so much. And I think there's so much wisdom to be learned from people that have done it a little bit ahead of us. So hopefully anyone listening today finds some comfort in that. If people want to find you or your brilliant work online, where should they go?
You can find us on the Outer Sanctum podcast Instagram page, or you can find us on the Making the Call Instagram page. We like Instagram. We do get a bit chatty on the old tweets, but if you're a new parent, I wouldn't be on Twitter. There's no need to go to that bin fire. So yeah, you can find us on all the socials, Making the Call or the Outer Sanctum podcast. And if you are sport curious, or you just want some company while you're doing the parenting and you want some adult company, do listen to one of our episodes of the Outer Sanctum podcast, because, you know, the last 8 episodes that would come up in your feed are not necessarily that sport heavy.
They're I've really told about very, themes. Very non-sport fans that they have to listen.
Yeah. I'm interested to know, I mean, we don't know what the effect of having podcasts in our ears. Like, I certainly find that having a podcast helps me parent better, because I feel like I'm learning as I'm working in the house, and it keeps me company. And I think back to little Lucy, you know, she barely had a fax machine, you know, when she first had her kids. You know, you had kind of none of that stuff.
I had to tape ABC Kids. If the kids were sleeping through play school, like, you had to record it.
Just
because you didn't even
imagine that now.
I know.
Yeah, it's crazy.
There was nothing on demand.
But think about what Lucinda's going to be like. You're going to be like created in a lab parent, like the best of all everything's. You've listened to so many people's stories. I want to come back and visit with Posey and Ray and ask you in like 10, 12, 15 years time, how did it affect your parenting, listening to all of this? Because you are such an active listener. I'm so intrigued. You're at the University of Parenting. You've done that to yourself.
Interesting. But Emma, I wonder, do we take it in at the time, as we've discussed? Mm. How much do we take in? Well, one thing I've definitely been cognizant in recent interviews is finding the joy in motherhood, because I think in my first year, the sort of angry feminist came out a bit more, realizing what it means to be the birth giver, the womb holder, all of those things. And I think, interestingly, if I've learned one thing, it's that, yes, it's hard and that's okay, but to try my best in the moment to enjoy it. But if I'm listening to the rest of it, I hope I am. But am I taking it all in? We'll have to check back in 15 years.
It's a time capsule, Lucinda.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe, or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.